We're going to go ahead and get started. We have, first afternoon, a very good update on affordable housing plan. We have some information in our packet provided by Terry Spaeth, I believe, or Gary Newman. So maybe we'll lead off with that. I think they wanted to share a couple comments, and then we've got Rochester Area Foundation and HRA
here to talk
about their comments. So, Gary, or?
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay.
Steve asked me to cover 30 years of city work on housing in 10 minutes, so I'm going to try to do that.
10 minutes.
The city role in housing, I don't think, has been very well understood. We've had a lot of questions lately. What has the city done in housing, going way back to when the county did the report? So we thought this might be a good opportunity to clarify what we've been working on. I'm going to recap as an overview. The federal role in Rochester, you know, they were the lead player in affordable housing in the 60s, 70s, early 80s. About in the 80s, the number of units we had from the feds pretty much stagnated. Wasn't going anywhere. Then they adopted a new tax credit program in 1986. It really got rolling in a lot of places in the 90s. We've used that pretty extensively in Rochester, probably starting about 2000. As far as the state role, the state didn't play any significant role to my recollection or others that I've talked to on expanding the supply of affordable housing in Rochester. It's only recently they've had some money for affordable housing with the last couple bonding bills. The county provided operating staff costs for the HRA. They got a lot of it from the federal housing program. They did not really play a big role in expanding the supply of affordable housing units. It was mainly taking care of the ones that were there. The county staff, planning and HRA, they were very strong advocates for all types of affordable housing. Phil Wheeler, Gary Leaders, Teresa Fogarty all advocated for the county tax levy several times over the years. Finally, due to the new council, the board that's in effect, they enacted that in 2015, but it came up several times in the past. Rochester Area Foundation became a very strong partner for the city in the expansion of the supply of housing units for a period of about 8 to 10 years. The foundation deserves a lot of credit for that, along with their funders. There was actually back in that era, Mayo Clinic and the Chamber and the RAF came to the city and asked what the city could do to help with affordable housing before they hired staff and started working on housing, and I'll explain what we did in a bit here. So all those funding partners should be thanked, as well as the RAF, for that. The city was a partner with the RAF in almost all of their housing units. We did tax increment financing to put anywhere from $8,000 to $12,000 per units in, I think, almost all of their units. So the city was a public partner that partnered with the private partners that the RAF brought to the table. We were using, during that era, municipal funding tools of tax increment financing, housing revenue bonds, block grants, and gifting of city lands for various housing projects, because we were doing housing projects basically all the way back to the mid-1980s. Our records are, those records are now long gone. They're in deep storage in the basement of the airport and other places. So we only go back to 1999. But I would mention the city was the first organization to use tax increment financing in this area, maybe in the state, for single family housing projects. We did it for a 16 unit subdivision in West Zumbro, which I'll explain a little bit later. It was a site that the homes had to be removed for flood control. We filled the site up. We used the lots and tax increment financing to underwrite the cost to make it affordable. We had an RFP process and selected a developer and built built the houses there. Subsequent to that, we did a scattered site development of 64 units, in which, again, we used tax increment financing to underwrite the cost and make it affordable to people buying it. Then after that, the subsequent thereafter is when the Chamber and the Mayo Clinic and the Foundation came to the city and said, what can we do to help them? Because they were committed to doing some affordable units, and we said we can do what we've been doing on the last two projects, and we would be their partner. And the City Council at that time made a commitment to do up to 1,000 units of partnership with the RAF and did tax and rent financing on I think almost all of the units that RAF worked on. I will say the good news is most of those tax increment financing districts already have been decertified, so those properties are on the, all the taxes from those homes are now coming to the the taxing units. But the numbers are there, 367 units of affordable single-family units, 287 done with the foundation, 80 that we did prior to that, 725 workforce rental apartments, 408 senior apartments, 88 student. We did more than this, but they're not on the list. I know we did the two handicapped housing projects in town, downtown and North Broadway. We did many others, but they go back before 1999. We also have been using housing revenue bonds. Housing revenue bonds are repayable by the project, but if they meet certain low-income housing criteria, the city can issue bonds that get some tax-free tax rate, and then it helps them to rehabilitate or construct new affordable housing units. We've done that on the list of the projects shown on this sheet. That's not all of them. I know we did the Gates way back, which was the largest one I think we ever did. Next sheet, that's where I mentioned the West Zumbro Estates subdivision, the flood homes, where we did 14 single-family homes with a developer using tax increment financing. We donated two lots to Handicapped for Habitat for Humanity. We also donated the former Silver Lake Motel site we bought for the flood control project to the HRA, $450,000 for the construction of the River's Edge apartment building. We donated 24 properties we bought for flood control worth over $2 million to the, actually half went to the HRA, half to the housing partnership. Eventually all those 24 went to the HRA. We did more gifting than this, but that's all we can recall at this time. It was a long time ago. Block grants. We've used community development block grants to do a single family rehab program since 1987. We've done 350 homes, a value of $5.4 million in block grants that we put into that. It addresses two main needs. One is low-income housing. The second is it encourages additional private investment in the communities. We think it's been a terrific project for the city. We think it's helped prevent some slum and blighting conditions that otherwise probably would have occurred. We also, again, in partnership with the RAF, we got $1.6 million in neighborhood stabilization program funding. That's after the credit home mortgage crisis. There were a lot of foreclosed homes. We got some funding for that. We ended up spending that money, an additional $2.5 million in program income on 19 single-family homes and a four-unit condo building. Other housing things the city's done over the years, we've used block grants for quite a few things to help nonprofit organizations. The city's funded the Women's Shelter, High Above the Homes, Bear Creek, Accessible Space, Habitat for Humanity, Gift of Life. We also gave some block grants to RAF First Homes, SemCell, ARC. They aren't on the list. We remember more of these as we go on, but then we'll go to, this is a project that some people don't think of as affordable housing. Phil Wheeler and I always thought it was. And it had two main objectives. It was a water quality protection program. Since the 60s, people have known there was a problem with failing septic systems in township areas on small lots outside Rochester. In 1998, that became the number one priority in the 1998 sales tax of the city. It was pushed by Phil, Richard Fries, our office, and the mayor and council strongly supported it. It assisted over 1,500 homeowners with failing well and septic systems. It was not a direct city responsibility, but no other government unit had a way to fix it. And so the city went in and fixed it. It was low-income homeowners on small lots. Homes wouldn't sell in many cases. They could only sell them on a contract for deed. We went in and got 50% support for each subdivision we went into. Usually we'd go meet with them. Within a week, we'd have a petition to do the project. They'd pay some assessments. The city underwrote the assessments with sales tax, and it worked great. The townships approved them. They were next to the city, and away we went. That project started in 1999. We expended almost all the funding already by 2005 because it really went like hotcakes. I think my final comment that I'll do one more after that real quick. I think all the mayors and councils that we've worked with over the years have had a very strong interest in housing assistance. And I'd say outside of the federal government, I think the city's been the strongest and the longest and most consistent supporter of affordable housing. Some of the projects we're currently working on, we're working on Buckeye Flats, which is 19 units of 50% affordable housing. First Avenue Flats, which is 68 units of 60%, I believe, median income housing. Valley High Villas, which is senior, 139. River Glen is 204 senior units. 434 units is what we're working on currently. I do think the tax credit things that they've done for the federal government has been a really nice program and helped kind of replace kind of the lack of federal investment in housing that occurred kind of in about a 10-year window, 15-year window in the 80s and early 90s. So that's it. That's kind of just to explain what we've been doing. Give you a copy of it.
Okay.
We're done.
Any questions for Mr. Newman?
Thanks.
All right. Then next up, Mr. Wojcik.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I've got a few introductory remarks, and I'm going to hand it over to three topic area experts in the area of affordable housing locally and what we're doing and what we can do as a community. I was asked to start with a comment, you know, very often used by Dr. Noseworthy and others, that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And there has been a lot of working together, particularly through the activities of the Rochester Area Foundation and the Housing Task Force and Steering Committee in recent years. However, we got the wheels stuck in the mud a little bit. And the real issue here was I've been asking for a update for the community, because I believe the community is due an update, because we were supposed to have a housing plan out in November of 2014. It's now 18 months after that, so we've got some catching up to do, and over the course of the 18 months, the affordable housing issues that we have here in the community of Rochester have not magically fixed themselves, unfortunately, and as such, it is an ongoing concern. In terms of some of the folks that chose to come out here, I'd like to recognize a couple of county commissioners. I see Commissioners Podolsky and Kaskaden are here, and they've been both passionate supporters for housing. I see that we have folks from in the city for good who are here. I also noticed that we have Trent from Interfaith Hospitality Network, and we've got a whole bunch of people from St. Vincent de Paul. Ken Brown's here?
Yes, he is.
You should sit in the front row if you're like that. No, thanks for being here. And we've got a whole bunch of folks too that are involved as advocates. And key thing here is, if you are of the belief that we don't have an affordable housing crisis in the city of Rochester, I want to assure you that any of these folks will spend as much time with you as you need to make it perfectly clear how great the need is in this community. And we're also going to talk to the data, because we have real good data that talks about how much the shortage is and how many units we're going to need. I've been asked to define what is affordable housing, what it is we're talking about here today, because affordable can mean many different things to different people. The kind of programs that we're talking about, really what we're talking about is, in terms of ownership properties, things that can be done for folks at 80% of median county income, and for rental 60% or lower of median income. Now, a lot of people will say, I can't afford that, and that's very true, but by creating sufficient supplies in those price points, we hope that we'll be able to free some units at the lower end of the market as well. I also, every time I speak publicly about affordable housing, I always like to dispel some of the rumors and talk exactly what really does happen with affordable housing. Those people who believe that affordable housing bring crime or traffic problems or decreased property values in a neighborhood are shown to be wrong again and again and again. However, having quality affordable housing in a community does help improve health outcomes, and it helps improve the education of all the folks that are there, including the children there. We recently had some additional data that came out that showed, once again, job growth in this region outpaced the number of people in this region. Approximately 2,500 new jobs were had in the region, but only 1,100 new people in the county. And this has been the trend for a very long time. And since 1980, it's not commonly known, but the reality is more Americans have chosen to leave Rochester than have chosen to come here. Our growth has been through two things. One, we have a high birth rate, and the rate of births over deaths is fairly substantial. And we also have some international migration come here. If you're just looking at the American population moving to and from a community, we continue to lose out. Part of that is creating a community that's attractive, and we're working on that. But I believe a part of that probably is the availability of housing that people can afford to when they're doing the jobs here. We can all go up and down Broadway and see how many now hiring signs there are. Most of those jobs that are now hiring, they need affordable housing to house those people in our community. And without that, it's going to stagnate our economy. this is a regional issue. It's not just a Rochester issue, but as is often the case, Rochester must be the regional leader in terms of getting some policy in place and starting to create the number of units we're going to need as an economy. And the 2015 building code is fantastic from the standpoint that there is no low-quality construction anymore. Whether it's an affordable housing unit, single-family detached, multifamily, everything is built to a really high standard these days. And that means that we're not giving away jobs by focusing on affordable housing. We're actually going to be creating more jobs in the community. Finally, this is a little bit of the background from my standpoint, but what we're really here to do is not listen to me, but listen to some topic experts. And there's three groups that we're going to hear from today. First of all, one of the phenomenal partners we have in this is Greater Minnesota Housing. I believe John Ergo is going to be presenting, first of all, from them. And Warren, I imagine you're going to chime in once or twice as well. And after that, we're going to hear from our fantastic director of the Olmsted County HRA, who's really excited to have her in the community, and I joke that the housing issues are so tough down here. She commutes from the cities every day, so we'll get you a place down here. Don't worry, we're going to take care of you. But she's going to give us a little bit of update on what the HRA is doing, and hopefully answer some questions for the development community too, in terms of how do they engage with the HRA, and how do we convert this levy that we begin to do into some meaningful projects. And finally, we're going to hear from Steve Borkart and the Rochester Area Foundation. Obviously, the foundation has been the leader in trying to bring all these groups together and come up with some policy recommendations for us. And Steve's going to walk through. We're going to hear about three legs of a stool in terms of what we need, and one of those legs is creating a private fund that can help expedite some of these projects. I know Steve's going to touch on that to a great extent. And when we conclude, there's going to be two things. We're going to try and summarize on the key points of what some of the issues are and what we can do as a community. But most importantly, so that another 18 months don't go by, we're going to be given a set of recommendations for things that we can start to do today as the city of Rochester to substantially increase the number of the supply of affordable housing units in the community. And with that, I'd like to welcome all those that are joining us and hand the floor over to John Ergo from Greater Minnesota Housing.
All right, Michael, thank you very much for your introduction, and welcome everybody to today's conversation about affordable housing in Olmsted County. Just a couple of things. You might be asking, who is Greater Minnesota Housing Fund if you haven't heard of us already? And we've been around for 20 years supporting affordable housing development throughout the state of Minnesota. And you can see on this map, there's a fair amount in the southeast region of the state focused on Rochester. And we continue to be active here. We've got, Gary, you mentioned earlier, the plans. We've got some money going into that project. And we will continue to be active in the community. Gary, you also mentioned a brief history of Rochester's extensive affordable housing efforts. And we applaud those efforts, and we are thankful for the city's proactive approach, especially in light of federal cuts. And I don't want to jump too far to the end of my presentation here, but the housing framework is really all about recognizing the approach that the city has been taking over the past 20, 30 years, and the investments that the city has made in affordable housing and the programs that surround that. But we're also looking forward to the future and saying, how can the city expand on that a little bit? CDBG is being used? Yes, keep doing that. TIF is being used? Yes, keep doing that. There's public policy items that we can address too that will make a significant difference, but more on that in a moment. So Michael touched a little bit on, what's affordable housing. So I thought it would be good to have this as a little bit of a grounder for everybody to think about. The continuum of housing ranges everything from permanent supportive housing over here, which is people who are homeless or at risk of being homeless, all the way to market rate home ownership, executive move-up type single-family subdivision, and everything in between. And if you can go to the next slide. I've got some examples of each of these housing types just to sort of set the framework a little bit. So you might be familiar with Silver Creek Corner, which is permanent supportive housing with services, and that would be on this end of the spectrum. And a little bit further over under affordable rental housing, you have a place like Cascade Creek or First Avenue Flats, affordable rental housing built with tax credits. Then you've got some of the work that First Homes did, like Weigel Place, affordable multifamily home ownership, where you've got four units in this one house, or Valleyside, which is affordable single-family home ownership for that end of the spectrum. And then you've got market rate rental, like Metropolitan Marketplace that the Girard Company did a couple years ago in downtown, and then also market rate homes for sale in the community, an average price as of the Maxfield study that was done a couple of years ago at $200,000. So in reference to that housing study, Maxfield Research was commissioned by the county, by Mayo Clinic, and by Rochester Area Foundation to study the need for all kinds of rental housing and ownership housing in the county. Oops. And this is really focused was really focused on what's happening because of the Destination Medical Center initiative and what kind of growth is going to be driven by that. This is the study market area, just so everybody is grounded in this. It's Olmsted County, but it also includes some of the communities that are right on the edge, like Pine Island, which is partially in the next county up, and St. Charles, which is partially in that county. So not just Olmsted County, but a little bit outside of that. Jobs growth in Olmsted County. This is information from Rochester Olmsted City Council's governments. And you can see we're talking about 40,000 new jobs between 2010 and 2030. Substantial job growth in the area. Next slide. Accompanying this is projected to be strong population growth. These are per year, per decade changes, excuse me. So in the 2010 to 2020 decade, we're expecting over 23,000 new people moving into Olmsted County. At the same time that all this growth is going on, we have an average home price of $200,000, which cannot be afforded by many people in various types of lower paying jobs. At the time the Maxfield study was done in December 2013, the vacancy rate among affordable housing was 1% between workforce housing and senior housing. A little bit higher in the market rate side, but still below 5%, which is considered an equilibrium level for rental housing. There is a rent burden identified in the study. It said 58% of renters cannot afford the average market rent of $957 per month. The majority of renters are rent burdened, paying too much for their housing. Another way to put this, Rochester is the only MSA in the state, besides the Twin Cities, where two people have to work more than two full-time minimum wage jobs to afford the average two-bedroom apartment. That's not true of anywhere else in the state other than here and the Twin Cities. So in summary, without getting into all of the weeds, the market study really found that while market rate renters and home buyers are doing pretty well in this market, there's a crisis of need for people who are seeking affordable workforce housing. We have spent some time recently and updated the Maxfield numbers with 2014-2015 building permits for the city of Rochester. You're averaging about 300 single family homes built per year. Very few of those, if any, are priced under $200,000. Maybe some of the multifamily for sale, but not single family. There's been 1,530 multifamily units permitted in that two-year stretch. 1,148 of those were last year. Of those, 90% were for market rate units, and 10%, 158, were for affordable units. And of those 158, two of them were developments that Joe Weiss did. Thank you very much, Joe. And one was Gage East, which is under construction right now by Center City Housing. We've also updated the report to talk about the 2015 Wilder Homeless Study, which was just released a couple of weeks ago. And in the Southeast Continuum of Care region and statewide, it found fewer homeless households than the study that was done 3 years ago in 2012. But I would like to note that in this region, there are more homeless people and families now than there were 3 years ago. So it's not an issue that's going away. And here you can see a reflection of all these trends in the housing demand that's projected here through the year 2020, so over the next 5 years. Market rate housing, all new market rate housing is half of the demand. The other half is all affordable, whether it's new construction or the preservation of existing affordable housing. You can't have an existing project that times out, is no longer affordable, and then you have to build another one. So you have to keep this preserved first and also at the same time focus on new construction. This is a breakdown of the demand for the different kinds of rental housing, including workforce rental, senior rental, workforce for sale, permanent supportive housing, like we talked about. These add up to a total demand of 4,563 units over the next 5 years, so just about 900 units per year during that time. So what difference does affordable housing make? Affordable housing helps all number of groups, elderly, children, homeless, people that are working. Next slide. Stable homes create a foundation for early childhood development, school achievement, and career success. There are a number of studies that support this. We've got some quotes here. This is from Harvard, where if you don't have stable housing, kids are in trouble. Housing is a fundamental human need and the cornerstone of an equitable society. This gets into rent burden. People who are paying more than 30% of their income for housing have difficulty affording other necessities, including health care. A stable home shields children from unwanted moves that disrupt school attendance and educational achievement. I think the statistic is that for every move, you set a kid back like one-third of a grade. So if you move three times, you're set back from second grade to first grade. It's just that disruptive. Next slide. Homeless children face significant educational barriers. We need to address homelessness. If you don't address homelessness now, what ends up happening is 20 years from now, you have other issues. All right. This is a quote, Center for Housing Policy. We're talking about children with stable and affordable homes get better health care, better nutrition, they do better in school, lower rates of childhood diseases and obesity. Living in affordable housing near work also helps on the work front by reducing absenteeism. Investments in, oh, I'm sorry, I skipped a slide there. We can move to the next one. Other way. There we go. All right, investments in housing revitalize neighborhoods and spur further investment. We've seen this time and again. So you have improvements in homes. This attracts other investment. People have reinvested in their home, and it's reinforcing. You go to the next slide. First Homes, which has been mentioned a couple of times here, is a real model of this sort of success. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, like there was commented earlier, that Mayo was a big part of the First Homes initiative with $7 million committed. Another $5 million was leveraged from another 100 major employers. This $12 million resulted in $150 million worth of development and over 1,100 affordable homes produced. Here's some examples. This is the before of Cascade Creek in Cutsky Park. This is the after. This is 40 units of affordable housing. There's actually also in the background here a New Horizon daycare. And in the foreground of that New Horizon further down the street is actually some townhomes that are under construction right now. Community reinvestment. This is Weigel Place, which is at the very beginning of the presentation. Before and after. So before, single family, single home, dilapidated. After, four new affordable homes for families. And these are two community land trust homes completed by First Homes over the years. Just an example, First Homes actually has, I think, the second largest CLT in the state behind one in Minneapolis. All people in our community need housing that is affordable. Workforce housing is needed for job growth. This was touched on a moment ago. For every doctor, there are 16 ancillary staff that are needed. This tells you that when you increase hiring at Mayo or any other health care organization, it's not just the doctor at the top, it's everybody down below also. And we need to help them, otherwise that growth can't occur. So what's next? Well, there's great demand for affordable housing throughout Olmsted County, but how do we support that production going forward? It's going to take a public-private partnership. We have employers, philanthropy, civic leaders, local government. This is Greater Minnesota Housing Fund down here. We're all vested in what happens in Rochester and in Olmsted County. This is really dense and not for consumption on a big screen, even if it was bigger. But I will just run some quick highlights for you. As part of the conversation, GMHF has been trying to figure out, okay, well, what's the appropriate goal? What should we do? If there's a need for 900 affordable housing units per year, where should we start? I'll just tell you what this says. It's in your handouts if you'd like to read it more closely. In the ideal world, if we tried to meet 100% of the housing need identified, we'd be talking about, here's your 4,563 units.
John, you want to?
Sure.
Press.
Oh, what is it?
Press right there for you.
Not on the screen. Well, okay. What kind of technology are we using? Okay, so I'll just I'll continue here. So, so what are some tools that we can use to get there? Well, one of them is inclusionary housing, and we'll talk about that momentarily. But if you had a really strong inclusionary housing policy in the city of Rochester, you could be talking about over 150 units per year generated as affordable units. Here's Rochester CDBG. I think your allocation is $525,000 a year, and you split that between some owner-occupied rehab and other uses. If you try to do 100% of the housing need, you'd be needing $860,000 a year to do that. Tax increment financing. It was mentioned the city does about $8,000 to $12,000 per unit in tax increment financing. If you were to try to meet the need using this as a source, you'd need almost $4 million a year in TIF to get there. In fact, I know a couple of these other statistics here. Private equity, this is tax credit equity. If you tried to do this kind of production using Minnesota Housing's tax credit program, you'd be talking about using over 20% of the tax credits that MHFA has to allocate, which isn't going to happen in anybody's lifetime. It has to be distributed throughout the state. So while this would be great if we could meet this need, there's probably not enough money in the world to do this. So let's talk about what might be an appropriate goal. And that's what these over here are trying to talk about. The one on the far right is, we've got an HRA levy, which is terrific. And it took years to get that, and I think everybody is happy that that's happening. But if you only do that, and you don't do anything else, you maintain CDBG the way it is, you maintain TIF the way that it is, and you don't do any inclusionary housing policy, you're going to be talking about meeting 10 to 15% of the housing need each year. And so in 10 years, you'll finish the first year's worth of demand. So let's talk about something that gets us there a little bit faster than that. An aspirational goal might be, let's try to get 35 to 40% of the need in a particular year. And that's achievable. CDBG is still the same, TIF. This is driven mostly by the number of units, not by more per unit. Inclusionary housing is a big component of this, 113 units per year. All of these dollar amounts here that are filled in related to Minnesota Housing, Greater Minnesota Housing Funds, resources, deed, Federal Home Loan Bank. These are all sources for affordable housing. These are all numbers that are sort of reasonably within what those different entities would be willing to allocate to a particular region in a particular year over an average time. So thinking about those tax credits, instead of being 20% of all the allocation, you're more like 4%. That's in the ballpark. Minnesota Housing looks at job growth, population growth, cost burden as three metrics. And if you look at those three metrics, Olmsted County's fair share of state resources was probably around 4% of all those resources, tax credits, deferred loans, other kinds of resources. So that's what this is getting to. If you wanted to be a little bit more pragmatic and say, well, this seems a little bit aggressive, we want to be over in this realm here, and do maybe not as robust an inclusionary housing policy, then you can still leverage other funds, and you can still meet, 25 to 30% of the demand each year. And that might be where folks' preference is to end up. But you can just see what the order of magnitude is here in terms of, can't do this, too much money. Over here, you're never going to solve the problem. And in between here is probably where the goal lies. GMHF's role is not to tell you what the goal is. That's a community-driven process. And what we're laying out here is, these are some endpoints that you could hit. And you might end up, in the fifth column here with some mishmash of those two. But if you want to go to the next slide. What the takeaway is from that slide is, in order to accelerate affordable housing production, you need to leverage local resources and public policy. And right now, we've got the HRA levy, tax increment financing, CDBG, inclusionary housing, Rochester Area Foundation is working on private commitments of resources. All of these things are necessary in order to hit that bell in that previous slide. So moving forward in Olmsted County, the levy is in place. The private fund, Steve will be talking about that momentarily. So the next item on the agenda is address the public policy component. What can be done at a public policy level to move the needle on affordable housing? First, continue to use TIF. So Cascade Creek Apartments, First Avenue Flats, there are others, they're 100% affordable, they use TIF. I believe this is called the Park now, Cuskey Park Place. It's the new development on Civic Center, right opposite of Civic Center Drive by Girard. It's a recent example of a mixed-income project that has 20% affordable units, and that has tax increment financing also. That was a trade-off between the city and the developer. If you do 20% affordable, we'll give you a TIF. Everybody was happy. Continue using CDBG. You've got owner-occupied rehab. You should consider expanding that. It can leverage outside dollars. So Cornerstone Partnership is a name that folks might not be familiar with, but they're a national expert on inclusionary housing, and GMHF commissioned them to do a study related to Rochester and Olmsted County as part of the housing framework that we're putting together. Harnessing the power of public policy to align inclusionary housing policy with affordable housing goals and prioritize TIF and density bonus incentives for affordable housing. I'll talk about what some of those mean in a moment. What do developers say about inclusionary housing policies? Some of the things that, when Cornerstone did this work, they interviewed developers locally. They looked at their development pro formas, if they were willing to share, to identify is inclusionary housing economically feasible? What do developers think about the idea? It creates certainty in the process. It levels the playing field for all projects, and it can reduce the time spent gaining approvals. If you look at Girard is the example with the park. There's a lot of one-off conversations about using TIF for affordable housing. If there was an inclusionary policy in place, everybody would know what the rules were, and it would be a much quicker process. The recommendations that Cornerstone Partnership provided were to focus on developments of 10 or more units in Rochester, and there would be different requirements for affordability for single-family and for sale projects versus multifamily rental. What do I mean by that? Oops, go back one, please. Here we are. Okay, so what do I mean by that? In general, when a developer receives an incentive like TIF or a density bonus, in exchange, that would be the swap, right? So for inclusionary housing policy, if the developer does more affordable units, the city will give them the density bonus, allow them to do more units on the site, or give TIF to offset some costs. And the percentages associated with all of that are different, and it depends on the strength of the kind of policy that the city decides to implement, if it decides to implement one. So I'm not really going to get too much into the weeds on that, but just as a high-level explanation. Okay. I do want to get into the weeds just a tiny bit on some further recommendations. So the community already has density bonuses that are allowed for developers. If you do things like structured parking or additional setbacks or add balconies or do on-site stormwater management. So those are all really important things for development to have, right? You need parking, you want balconies to have an attractive a project. But some of these things probably should not be incentivized by using TIF or density bonuses. These are sorts of things that maybe should be zoning requirements. So if you think about what needs to happen sort of really into the zoning code, it's about changing how some of this works so that an inclusionary policy can actually be effective. Next slide. This is not readable at all, but there's a bigger blown up version of it in a pack out there. And really, this is getting into the details. This was done by Cornerstone Partnership. They evaluated the zoning code. They looked at all the different requirements that might be changed in order to have an inclusionary policy work. So in summary, I think it's important for the community to continue focusing on TIF and affordable and mixed-income housing, focus TIF on those kinds of projects, to consider expanding the use of CDBG, which is already being used, but consider expanding and doing more owner-occupied rehab, and also to pursue an inclusionary housing policy. Can you back up to that slide with all the big numbers on it, Steve? I just want to touch on what that means. Okay. So So, in this scenario here, if you have a requirement that 20% roughly of your units are affordable, if you get TIF, or if you get a density bonus, or if you get some sort of another incentive, that would be the number of units, 150 roughly per year that you'd be able to generate using that kind of a very strong inclusionary policy. If you dropped it down a little bit and said, well, let's how about 15%, then you're talking about 113 units per year. If you were at 10%, you'd be at about 66 units per year in round numbers. If you have no policy, you'd be at zero. So this is the power of that policy. If you have that public policy in place, not only with all this other money working behind the background to do other things, if you have that public policy, you can really boost affordable housing production.
What was the amount for the ideal world?
157 units per year.
What percentage is that?
20. About 20.
Thanks.
Yep. So that concludes my remarks. Anything else to add, anyone?
Any
questions
for John before we move on?
Could you maybe just touch, you may be the person for this too, but could you talk a little bit about the trend on communities and inclusionary zoning and also how HUD's fair housing rules have affected the discussion?
Well, we can say that Cornerstone Partnership is actually very active in the Twin Cities Metro right now. There are a number of communities that have already adopted or are considering adopting an inclusionary housing policy. And this is something that nationally has been going on for years. So we're kind of late to the discussion in Minnesota and here as well.
All right, other questions for John?
Just encourage the council to take a look at some of these because this is the, I appreciate the recommended changes here that you brought to us today because I think for the density bonus incentives, this is one the council has frequently kind of discussed about, is a balcony, for instance, a public benefit versus a private benefit and factoring that into the incentive development ordinance. So I appreciate that being brought to the attention again.
Sure.
All right.
Great. Thank you.
Who's next?
Cheryl's going to be next, but before she does, I'm going to jump in here I'm going to ask you to hang on to this in your head for when I talk, and I know you've got it in front of you someplace. Yeah. Real quick. This is what Maxfield says, in a perfect world, we're going to need to meet demand in our community, based on the report that was completed in May of 14. This was our aspirational goal. This means that if Maxfield was only half right, we haven't gotten there, and that's our aspirational goal. So why did we say that? Because we got about 20 capital campaigns going on in our community right now with a limited ability to aggregate funding for something like this. Now, this is the entire funding package. What we'd be looking at from employers and philanthropy is a little over $3 million a year. That's a pretty heavy lift with all the competition there is for capital campaigns in our community right now. So we said, we can't do that. We got to break it down to this. A mere quarter to one-third. So if they're only half right, we're only half there with that. And that's $2 million a year, which, based on some of the projects that have been brought before you and not too distant past, gives you an idea. And now you can look at that. But I just want you to kind of lock that into your brain. These numbers didn't come out of the clear blue. These are solid numbers. And they don't get us halfway to what Maxfield said we were going to need.
Thanks, Dave. So if you weren't sober before.
Now that's me and my beautiful bride and my 1.5-year-old grandson.
Good afternoon, everyone. My portion of the presentation is somewhat shorter. I'm here to update you on where the HRA is at with reestablishing itself as a community partner and what the work that we've done towards implementing the HRA levy with our new HRA board. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I think I've met pretty much everybody in the room, but in case I haven't met you, I'm Cheryl Jacobson. I'm the Housing Director, Executive Director for the Olmsted County HRA. I've been in my position now, I'd like to say almost a year and a half. So we've reached over that 12-month period. So getting used to the world down here in Olmsted County, which, as you heard John talk about over the course of the past few months, housing is a pretty big deal here in Olmsted County and in Rochester. So, in John's presentation, he talked about the HRA levy and the role that the HRA levy is playing in the overall toolbox for providing affordable housing. One of the areas that, in my role as housing director, I've been working on is implementing, along with the Olmsted County Board of Commissioners, a new HRA Board of Commissioners. And so we have been working on that since January. Our HRA board has 8 members, and 7 of them are the Olmsted County Board of Commissioners. And they, in the transition and in the approval of the HRA levy, elected to appoint themselves the HRA Board of Commissioners, and so sought special legislation to do that. We were successful in the legislative session last year in getting that passed. And so the county board, as the HRA board, seated themselves in January. So we are fairly new with working with each other, but we do have the 7 county commissioners plus 1 resident commissioner as our board. So we are under the leadership and direction of an 8-member board. We have our officers. Our chair is Commissioner Paul Wilson. Our vice chair is Commissioner Lou Oley, and our secretary is Commissioner Stephanie Fidelke. And so our board is important to us because they really do provide the leadership and direction. We are working with them over the course here to define mission and goals, set our strategic direction. I've been pushing a lot of policies at them over the past few months. And we'll be addressing the strategies for the HRA. They ensure that our operations are undertaken in accordance with laws and program requirements. As was mentioned early on in the introductory comments, the HRA longstanding programs have been the Housing Choice Voucher and the Federal Public Housing Program. We still operate those programs. I think from what I could tell in records, it looks like much of that funding came to us in the late 70s, early 80s, so they're longstanding programs. And we are still operating and administering those programs. So those are turning and keep going. We have been working on some new policies for the authority. With the HRA levy coming into place, we have to create some new programs and some new policies. So as we look towards our future, we are looking to reestablish and build our organization. We want to be known as a solid community partner. We have a multi-purpose community partner role. Somewhat behind the scenes of that, we are working to build our organization. We moved from the planning department to the community services department, which has offered us great opportunity to marry and partner housing with services. In the housing world, we are seeing many times those in need of affordable housing are also accessing and utilizing many community services programs. So moving the HRA under the community services department has been a great advantage to us. We can link up our programs with community services programs. Oh, go back. We've also been working on establishing or reestablishing our foundational items. We've had some policies that needed to be updated. We've updated budgets and plans. And we are working on some operational and administrative process improvements and so that we can be more efficient as we grow and change in the future. So one of the biggest areas that we are looking to establish is to address, obviously, the affordable housing crisis or need. And to do so, the Olmsted County Board last fall approved the HRA levy, which we've all heard about now, seen some numbers. So we're looking at pursuing and promoting more partnership opportunities within the availability of that HRA levy, and then also build the HRA levy program, because we have the dollars now, but we don't really have any programs behind it. So when we were proposing the levy, Paul Fleissner and I built the OCCS, which stands for Olmsted County Community Services Housing Continuum. And we based the HRA levy proposal off of three bucket areas that we were proposing to spend and target HRA levy dollars. And so the first one, we kind of peel off the administrative side of it. We, like I said, we have our federal programs that we operate, and unfortunately the federal government has not been really good about fully funding federal programs. And so we do have some shortfalls within our federal programs, and so we are using some of our levy dollars to plug those holes, plug what the federal government has not given us. So we are targeting about $350,000 towards those shortfall areas, again, primarily within our federal programs. And then moving on, focusing on three other development areas or three other buckets of funding. The first one focuses on homeless prevention and housing stability. In our budget plan, we targeted $100,000 towards this area. And these funds really focus on housing stabilization for families and homeless youth. And so an example of a program or a service that would come out of this bucket area would be short-term rental assistance or security deposit assistance, something that might assist that homeless youth with getting into housing close to their schools. Same with families. Also under this category, potential funding areas could be towards transitional housing and emergency type housing. I'm going to jump over to the one on the far end, housing rehabilitation. We decided to target about $400,000 towards the housing rehabilitation category. This focuses on a couple different areas. One is to really enhance the City of Rochester's CBG rehab program and look at creating a county-wide home improvement program, especially focusing on low and moderate income homeowners, specifically seniors who may need accessibility modifications within their home so that they can continue to live in their home. And then target those new dollars towards the smaller cities of Olmsted County and really make it a county-wide rehab program. Also looking at targeting some of those funds to repair and update the HRA's properties. We are a property owner and manager, and so we have some home improvement needs of our own. And so looking at funding some of those needs out of this category of funds. Our last category of funds, and probably the most popular category, is our housing development account. And so the HRA levy was approved in September, and it was for 2016. And so we have $1.35 million. And not all of that, as you can see, is going to be directed towards housing development, and John went through those numbers as well. But they are very popular. I've had a lot of developers already call with interest in the area, interest in building affordable housing, mainly within Rochester. And so this portion of the levy would really be to partner the HRA in this first category here with private and nonprofit developers to actually produce or develop workforce housing. We would be their partner. So workforce housing, senior housing, or supportive housing. The second category or potential programming area that we could do, depending on how we develop it, would be a housing production trust fund or a gap financing program. And this is what has been most popular with folks looking to produce affordable housing. And so what would this be? There's other funds that other HRAs have pulled together, gap financing programs, and basically what they are is kind of last-in funding. As a developer goes through the application process with maybe the state of Minnesota, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, they maybe get to the very bottom of their performa, and they have a gap. And so in this category, the HRA levy dollars would be the last in funder to fill that gap. And so the idea with that is we would have an application process where we would, at a certain point in the year, make that funding available through an application process. Interested developers would apply to us. We would evaluate and rate the applications and award funding commitments based on pre-established criteria. The idea with that is they could then take that funding notice and go to others and actually leverage it. It would be more of a solid local commitment towards state dollars in order to bring the state dollars in. So that would be our gap financing program. The last part of the housing development area would also focus on preservation of existing housing units. We've had a couple units within Olmsted County, or a couple developments within Olmsted County, that have opted out or have reached the end of their affordability requirements and now are market rate. And so maybe some of these funds could work with those owners or developers to preserve and really keep those units affordable within the area.
From the U.S. Conference of Mayors, I chaired the Task Force for Veterans Affairs, and it always comes up, and I don't know what the situation is here in Washington County for military veterans. What's the amount, maybe our numbers, and are any of these categories taken into consideration, any of the veterans that are homeless?
I'm not sure on the actual need, but from an HRA standpoint, we work with Veterans Housing Authority through a rental assistance program through it's called VASH is its acronym, and it's Veterans Assistance Supportive Housing Program. Thanks, John. What that is a partnership between the VA and HUD, and I'm not sure how long we've had the vouchers, but they came in and they said, we've looked at your numbers, and we think that you could support the use of 10 VASH vouchers. And so the HRA received 10 VASH vouchers that we use to assist eligible veterans. I do know that they're trying to fully utilize that program, and so I don't know if they're reprogramming dollars or if they're actually looking at funding more, but I was contacted about the need for additional rental assistance vouchers, and so we have said yes, that if we were awarded them, that we'd absolutely take them and could use them. These dollars, we could address veterans assistance through the homeless prevention category. If we had a developer that wanted to come in and produce housing specifically for veterans, that could be an eligible development category. And even on the rehab side, if there was some rehab needs that maybe a veteran needed, or accessibility rehab, could be addressed through there.
Because I think both Minneapolis and St. Paul have pledged to be more veterans should be homeless. I don't know what all goes into that, but
yes. Nationally, there's a push to use the veterans rental assistance fully and to fully utilize those dollars.
Thank you.
That's it. Any questions?
Questions for Cheryl?
Maybe just a general question. I mean, going forward, is there going to be a toolkit or something for developers to come in contact with the HRA and figure out how to potentially utilize those resources? Obviously, everyone's interested, but nobody's, you know, there's not necessarily a set way that they go about doing that.
That's correct. There's not a set way at this point. In working with the County City Planning Department and County Administration, I would hope that we could get to that point where developers are either pointed to us or pointed to the city, and we can kind of loop them around each other so that we know when applications are due, we are in touch with the state most times, and so it would be my hopes that we could create that one door or front door for a developer, so that we weren't passing them back and forth. But nothing exists at this point, but we're early in design as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, good. Mr. Borkhardt, you're on.
Mind if I sit so I can run my technology here? So why RAF? Can I see it all down there? Certainly it has been mentioned several times, Gary and Michael. The foundation got very involved in 2000. I won't go into all the history. Warren Hanson, the Railroads of the Housing Fund, was instrumental in that process, was a part of that. But suffice it to say, it came to the foundation, asking if the foundation would provide leadership on this, because for various reasons, it didn't feel like it had a natural home in a variety of other potential leadership positions in the community. And this is one of the things that community foundations do. In addition to maintain the community endowment bank, they take leadership in positions or issues that don't necessarily have an easy home otherwise, and they try to convene the community on thorny issues. So as it was, and we had gone through the recession, and things had changed with our housing initiative, and Joanne Stormer, our president, got together with the county and with Mayo, and said we'd better take stock of what our housing situation is again, because we're hearing that things are getting tight. And they commissioned we first of all held the summit meeting of October 2013 of the community, and of course, as you probably know, the results of that was we need to formally assess what the circumstances are in our community relative to housing right now. So the Maxfield Research Corporation was retained, and they put out their findings in May of 2014, and we've quoted from them liberally since then, or during this meeting so far. And we commenced to begin to write the framework for a plan, much like what had been done in 1999 following the Partnership 2020 Community Study. Warren volunteered, the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund staff, in the name of John and, of course, himself, to provide the expertise and the leadership to write that framework. And so we assembled a group of community folks that were from the development community, who had built multifamily facilities, some who had been involved in single-family facilities, and represented the professional organizations around development, and some just interested citizens, and convened them into a steering committee. And they came down probably once every 5 weeks or so for the better part of a year, and we attempted to write the plan. And we got right up to about last June through August of last year and became stalemated for a couple of reasons. The county was going to pass the HRA levy, and how much they passed and how much they raised with that levy would directly impact how much we would have to raise through philanthropy to fill the local need. And also, it became apparent that once we had this plan blessed by everybody and everybody agreed to participate, it was going to take a staff person from someplace to lead the charge. And they put their heads together to raise the funding necessary, and that was done by November. And at some point after November, Joanne looked down the hall and said, "Borkhardt, it's about time you work full time again." And I said, "Yes." And so that's what we've been doing. Now, since the first of the year, I've been revisiting with many of the people that were involved up to that point and asking two questions. First, do you believe there is sufficient consensus in the community that we are at a point of crisis relative to housing accessibility and availability to compel folks to give to a fund to facilitate the creation of that housing? And number two, if you think that, do you think there's consensus that creating a local fund to help buy down the cost of creating that housing is the best strategy? Because it was very clear that we needed to know that we had community support on the front end and that we had support for the concept. Now, this concept of creating a local fund is relatively rare. In other areas of the state, they've identified projects, they fund those projects through a variety of different funding mechanisms, but we were the area that really put this process on the map, correct me if I'm wrong. back in 2000 when the War on Drugs plan and a relatively small group of community people went to the Mayo Clinic and made their pitch, and Mayo understood the gravity of the situation and blessed them with a $4 million grant with a promise of another three if they raised it in the community, which they then did through diligent fundraising over the next few years. But they were able to start with a $4 million grant, and which was significant. And not to in any way discount the efforts that were put forth at that point in time, but when you go out with the community with a housing program and you go talk to developers and the people that produce housing and say, I happen to have $4 million that we want to infuse into the local economy to create housing, you can get people's attention pretty quickly. Doors open. And so we're in a little bit different situation at this point in time. We have a different economy. Our lead funder is hinting that they can't afford to provide us with that kind of support, and then we're going to have to approach this capital campaign. And I really hesitate to even use the terms capital campaign because it typically denotes a project for a building or a project. And what we're going to be interested, or what we are interested right now in doing, is standing up a community organization that is sustainable in the long term. And I'm getting through my slides. I did some of the before and afters also to credit to past accomplishments. And it's a CLT, but I'm going to rush through them now because John had a bunch of the same slides, and Gary almost already referenced this. To start now with what I started with, why the foundation? Do we have the formal authority to compel anybody to comply or participate? No. The formal statutory authority to compel policy is right here and in the county. Do we have the financial wherewithal in a local foundation to provide incentives for action? A little bit, but not enough to do what we need to do by a long shot. The developers, the bankers, the private equity folks, they can bring the resources to bear that can make things happen pretty quickly. Your local foundation, despite all of the success that was achieved by that foundation over the last 15 years, we dare not assume that the foundation is just going to take care of it because we don't have statutory authority and we don't have a money machine in the back room. What we do have is the ability and commitment to convene, coordinate, and lead. We've been asked to do that again, and that's what we've agreed to do. And the goal is to create a voluntary and collaborative and long-term sustainable organization that assembles government, business, and you can read the rest of it. I won't read to you. Now, why? Because the inputs to create a unit of housing have gone up faster than wages, than compensation has. And right now, there is no appearance that those two lines in the graph are going to start to come back together. They're accelerating like this. And there's no indication that the cost inputs to create a unit of housing is suddenly going to dip and so that it meets compensation rates. And there's no indication compensation rates are suddenly going to spike to catch up with what it costs. The numbers that were provided in the Maxfield study of $199,000 for the cost of a living unit or for a average for-sale house have been left in the dust in the last few years. One of the things that I learned when I went around the community asking community leaders if they thought we were at a sufficient point of crisis, I heard a real mixed message coming back. It was surprising the number of people that weren't convinced that we were there. And that's understandable when you think about it. If you haven't been in the housing market, either selling a house or trying to buy a house in the last year, you would have no way of knowing that in the last 6 months, a house that's in decent condition, priced under $200,000, has accelerated in asking price by at least $10,000 in the last 6 months. The stories I've been getting just in the last couple of days of houses in decent repair, three-bedroom, 60, 70 years old, going on the market for $159,900, six offers by 4 in the afternoon, and one of those offers was for $170,000, and that person didn't get it. It went for more than that within a day. And those stories are become common in the for-sale market. I visited with a well-known realtor just this morning, who informed me that they're seeing more and more sellers with contingent listings. Now, you've all heard of contingent offers. I'll offer so much on this house, but I provided my house sells. And if you get a better offer before my house sells, then I have to perform, right? You all know what that is? A contingent sale is, I'm going to list my house. If somebody comes along and wants to buy it, I have X number of days to go find something to move into, and if I can't, I can call the deal off. That's kind of a new way of approaching selling a house, and that's because the market is so tight at every level that they're unable to find a place to go move to, and I'll get to that a little bit more in a minute. So what's the snapshot of today? I did this just this morning. I contacted Maddox, Jacobson, their websites, and I called Paramarkets, spoke to them by phone. Two-bedroom apartment, under $900 per month. One on the market today. One-bedroom apartments, under $800 per month. Eight. Now, that's an interesting thing, the apartments, because if those of you that are close to this know that in the last year, you've seen a real spike in the intentions to build apartments, and you've seen them jumping up all over the community, and that is contributing to this notion that we really don't have an issue by some. I've heard numbers as high as 3,000, either coming out of the ground or on paper. Is that accurate? I'm looking at Gary. Why are you looking at me?
There was about 1,400 in last year, I think.
Started last year, but there's about 3,000 in the pipeline.
I thought that was the right number, so thank you. I just kind of pulled it.
You're going to start building soon.
In any event, that does create the illusion. Now, there are people that are close to that business that are suggesting that we may be overbuilding and we may be driving down the cost by oversupply. Has that started to happen yet? It certainly has not started to happen right now. It's very, very difficult to find an apartment. In addition to that, if you do have an apartment, you have a lease of at least a year. And with many of those leases, you have a 30 or 60 day out clause. And so if you announce that you're going to get out of your apartment, you have, in some cases, 60 days, in some cases, 30 days to perform. That means you have to go find a place within that period of time. In today's market, that's very difficult. For sale single-family homes under 130, and I'll tell you in a second why I touched on 130. Today, there are 39 on the market. For this month of 2016, we had a sales volume, March of 2016, had a sales volume of 1.6 million. A year ago, for that same month, there was 97 of those units on the market with a sales volume of 4.5 million. I'll leave that there. Now, this one is in the weeds, and it's hard to read, and I didn't make a copy for you. I apologize for that. But this is just a little down and dirty arithmetic when we start to talk about who are we talking about. We're just going to make your eyes glaze over with data here. So what I want to do is put a human face on this. Area median income 2014 in the county of Olmsted, $67,000. It's 63 in the city of Rochester, but I went a little higher. That's household income. So at 80%, which is kind of a round number, now if you add kids in there and you go to the HUD criteria, you can go higher for incomes. But just a round number that's easy to figure, 80% of average or area median income. 53.6. That's a gross monthly income of 44.67. Now, the mortgage people will tell you they will loan you, they will give you a mortgage for up to 30% of your monthly gross, provided your total monthly indebtedness obligation doesn't exceed 42%. With that in mind, the bank would give you, based on that, with good credit rating, the bank would give you a mortgage for $1,340, principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. Assume taxes and insurance at $300. That's $940 you'd have left for a principal and interest payment. You should be able to buy a house for $217,000. No problem, right? 80% of AMI, you're in like Flynn. When you really do a budget for somebody making that kind of money, a narrow budget, a skinny budget, a budget that doesn't include investments and vacation funds and Christmas funds and what have you, what you really end up with is a net income of $3,252. What you really end up with for availability for a housing payment is $852 a month. And if that's all you have available for your PITI mortgage, and you do the arithmetic based on $200 a month for taxes and insurance, you're down to a house that costs about $136,000. So, $53,600 a year household income. One person making $25.77, or two people making just shy of $13 an hour, with assuming one school-age child. and you're in a house for 136. I just showed you the numbers for how many houses were available under that. They jumped down to 75%. You have about $50,000 a year. Most people look around and say $50,000 household income. Not bad, huh? You're about down to 93.5 if you're going to buy one. $649. You need at least a two-bedroom apartment for that single parent and their school-age child. And what did I just show you for apartment availability for $650? 70%, you might as well not even talk about buying a house. $46.9 a year. If you can find one to buy, and if you think you can afford it, you probably can't afford to mow the lawn and shovel the walk. So, do we have a problem? Do we have an accessibility and affordability issue that's facing us? People making $25.77 an hour. Now, if you have two people, two partners making $26 an hour, we don't have to talk about you. You're in the normal market. But many cases, it's less than that. And you can all think of circumstances. Death and divorce visit many people. And you can suddenly find yourself in a situation where you can't afford your whole house. And guess what? You can't afford something to move into. So what can the city do now? It's already been touched on, and I'm reiterating for the purposes of concluding the kind of a call to action, if you will. What can you folks do right now? And we believe that getting to work on an inclusionary zoning ordinance is a smart thing to do. Certainly, you probably have your opinions as to what percentage an inclusionary zoning ordinance should be, or whether or not it should be governed by a stick or a carrot heavy or stick heavy. I would encourage you to withhold judgment on those kinds of issues until you've had valid research by a consulting firm that is knowledgeable in this issue, that can give you good information from which to make good decisions. With 3,000 apartments coming, if you had a 20% inclusionary zoning, mandatory 20%, you'd have 600 apartments coming in at the rate that would fit the folks that we're talking about. I'm not going into detail on the second one because I borrowed it from somebody else. John and Michael have the authority on this one, but adopt the density bonuses. And last but not least, commit to participation in our initiative. Now, this should be the easiest one because, as Gary pointed out, the city has been very involved. The city has been a robust partner. And the city staff has been attending the meetings we've had so far. But just so we're clear on mission and bring it back full circle, your local foundation doesn't have the authority to compel anybody to attend anything. This is all voluntary, and it's collaborative because the people in the community see the value proposition of coming together and doing this planning as a community. So I would ask you, as our elected body in the city, to formally commit to being a participant and assign staff so that they know this is a priority for you. And that will be a big move all by itself. Do you have any questions for me?
Questions?
Now I'll touch on just a little bit of what's happening. We have reassembled the steering committee. That larger ad hoc group has been now boiled down to a group that wants to stay on long term. We have just created a marketing and communications subcommittee because from the interviews I did in the community and from the reactions around the table at our first meeting, we're not ready to determine which of those funding options. They want a better idea of exactly who we're talking about. And there's this pervasive sense that the community isn't convinced this is necessary yet. So we have put together a group that will focus on telling the story. The next step that I've already embarked on is assembling a collection of the people that have done this for us in the past, our developers, the people that have built single-family homes and that have financed single-family homes and that have created apartment buildings, and put them in a room and ask them, what are the obstacles, what are the impediments to being able to create a unit of housing for $175,000? You can find some townhouses and some two-bedroom, single-bathroom or bath-and-a-half slab-on-grade townhouses out northwest for anywhere from $155,000 to $165,000. So a few are being built. But what are the obstacles to more of that? Is it cost? Is it I can go down the road and make a lot more money building at another level? Is it whether we don't really know that there's a market for that to go into it in a big way, and we don't want to speculate on a significant investment and find out that there's just not that many people out there that are willing to live that way? And so if we can assemble a list of the obstacles in the opinion of the experts, then we can begin to determine which of those we think we can chip away at. Some of them may be governance and policy oriented. Some of them may be we need to provide incentive funding to buy down the costs to experiment with a model of housing that has not been proven to have a market yet. We may have to accept the fact that starter homes aren't going to be new builds anymore, that they're going to be 50-year-old three-bedroom ramblers in an older part of town. But in order to free them up, those people need to go someplace. So there needs to be a robust market at 2.25 and 250 and 275 so they can move up. So it's a balanced market inventory kind of situation, and that's the next step for this group. The ultimate goal is to set the stage for putting together, dare I say it, a capital campaign, a fundraising effort to aggregate a central fund to be able to provide the subsidies necessary to buy down the inputs so that we can provide housing for people that make this kind of money.
All right, thank you. Couple of comments that come to mind as I listen. One, just a note item, on May 9th, I believe it is, we'll have our next joint City Council-County Board meeting, and housing is once again the topic of discussion, so we'll be talking, I assume, about many of these items again, and perhaps a little different flavor. Steve, you also touched on it, something I think is really important. It's important to have the right people around the table, the stakeholders, the development community, the bankers, as well as the policymakers. I think that it needs to be a community effort if we're going to make headway on this, and I'm very supportive of that. The other thing that I like seeing in one of the documents from Cornerstone Partnership is that we've been grasping at or grasping for tangible changes, and that's one of the first times I've seen some actual ordinance suggestions as far as things that we might address. And I think that's going to be part of the discussion, is we've got to get serious about this. One of the concerns I have as we talk about our revised comprehensive plan, as good as that might be, boy, there's a lot of work ahead of that as you actually start to talk about the zoning and changes and so forth that will follow on. So anything that we can do to expedite that, if it means addressing things like inclusionary housing or specific portions of the code, I think we should do that, make every effort. So I'm very supportive of wanting to move this forward in some fashion that we've got to ramp up the speed on this, or we're just going to continue to talk about it as we continue to fall further behind. Mr. Bilderbach.
Steve, can I make a request of you that you send your slides to Mr. Swindle so you can send those out to us? I think there are some interesting things on your slides.
All four of them I will send you.
That's one, because I think there are some interesting points that we need to make sure when we start looking at this.
Apologize for not having a copy.
No, that's fine. As long as we can get them, I appreciate it.
All right, Ms. Woodger.
Key thing here, and I am 100% with you that we got to get this thing moving, and one of the things that you saw, there were three recommendations that we can do today, and I would ask for consensus of the council that we direct staff to proceed with those three recommendations today.
I didn't see the. Can we put the recommendation back up, or is that gone?
The last slide. I think I've got them right down.
They were talking about begin the inclusionary yep. process, well, adopt
density
bonuses,
commit to participation.
Right. Yep. Perfect.
These are key. As you heard, they're going on in other cities, and Minnesota's been a little bit behind. But it requires us reaching out, getting some technical expertise, and Cornerstone and Greater Minnesota Housing are some great resources to start with. But ultimately, we need to take that step of blessing staff to go ahead and start working with us and bring us back some recommendations, and that's what I'm asking for.
Mr. Ruska.
It says begin drafting and adopt inclusionary housing ordinance, hire technical expertise. I guess I'm not real comfortable on jumping on all of this right now. you know, I guess I'm okay with again drafting and having some discussion and some input on this, but, you know, I don't know that we should all, at least I'm, you know, agreeing to adapting an ordinance not even, you know, seen yet. So I guess I'd kind of like to wait and see where we're going with that.
We're not asking anyone to adopt it. We're asking staff to start the work.
Well, that's what it says here. And so you said to agree to those things. And
okay.
So I just want to see
well, I will clarify. We want to, we want you to actually see the ordinance before you vote on it.
Well, Mr. Campion.
I just want to say, this is, I've been talking about this for a long time, being on the, and many of us having gone through the Planning and Zoning Commission and come up that way, you see these incentive developments come forward, and I think I just happened to timely publish some thoughts on incentive development process over the weekend, but I think this gets to the core of that it's a negotiation between the community and our goals as a community and the development community and their drivers, you know, profit or making the community better, whatever you like, and meeting in the middle to make sure we solve these problems in a way that is functional for everyone. And I mean, I have to commend the effort, but, and I'm disappointed I didn't see it until right now, but some of these about, you know, does this really justify a bonus? I think those are really important questions for us to start asking. You know, a lot of these projects are getting double dipping with TIF and incentive, and are we really getting the bang for our buck that we should be getting for projects and frankly for initiatives like getting affordable housing? So 100% supportive of directing staff to start maybe bringing forward a version of our ordinance here. It looks like 65-65, et cetera, that have been modified to incorporate these changes. I think that'd be a great start.
One question I think that'll come up in the discussion, kind of a reality check, and I don't think Mitzi's not here, is he? Mitzi Baker. One of the things I would want to ask is, what's the staff capacity? What's the priority? I don't want to just walk out of the room and throw one more thing on their pile and then it doesn't get done. So I want to just make sure that we have that conversation, make sure that we are prioritizing our requests appropriately. But Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I just want to get a clarification of what we're agreeing to today and what we're maybe perhaps going to wait until we talk to the county at our next joint meeting. So what are we exactly agreeing to today?
Well, that'll be part of the question. Mr. Roger?
Well, and what I'm looking for is, and you're right about the staff and concerns. In this particular case, I don't think we have anyone on staff that has that experience with inclusionary zoning ordinances that wouldn't necessarily do it themselves. That's why the request to hire some technically competent folks to help us prepare this would be, that would take it off our plate. That would be certainly one thing that we'd be looking to do. The second part that we do have to have that discussion with planning and zoning, I know they're doing it anyways, is the density bonus portion. And the third is probably just an official affirmation of what we're already doing, and that is the city continues to participate with RAF and their efforts. And I know I've been a part of that, you've been a part of it, and I think Terry Spaeth comes to most of those as well. So it's more just of an affirmation of what we're doing in that third one. Is that fair?
So what's the consultant piece? Are we going to do RFPs, or we're picking one firm ahead of time, or what's the...
Any suggestions for us, Warren?
My name is Warren Hansen. I'm the president of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. We spent, we contracted with them at Greater Minnesota Housing Fund and probably spent $30,000 last year just to help Rochester look at this situation. And they got so far because they couldn't take it all the way because there was more of a discussion that needed to happen. Quite frankly,
yeah, we needed to weigh in.
Yeah, you needed to weigh in. And so with the direction from the council, I think that there is only one preeminent expert in the country on inclusionary zoning, and it's Cornerstone Development. And they now have a legacy relationship with this community in terms of understanding your existing zoning code. And they're also working up in the Twin Cities with Edina, Hopkins, and St. Louis Park on inclusionary zoning, and City of Minneapolis on inclusionary zoning. So they have there's a state statute issue that they have to be familiar with too, in terms of conforming to the particular state statutes that relate to this. So they would be very, very ready to go. And if you did an RFP, you might end up with them in the long run anyway.
Is it possible to get from an organization like that some sense of outline. What would be the scope? What would be the deliverables? What
would be they're the very process? Good at that. They're you know, they work with all kinds of municipalities around the country, so they would give you exactly what you want. And in fact, if you invited a proposal from them, or if you wanted us to kind of do an intermediary role there, we could facilitate something and get that to you. But you could work directly with them, or we're real happy to keep involved for technical assistance.
And I think, you know, kind of taking the recommendations in reverse order, I think there is a commitment to participate. At least I'm personally committed to doing that. I think as we started off with Mr. Newman's discussion, we've demonstrated historically that we've been able and willing to put dollars into a number of these initiatives. So I think that question is somewhat answered, that we are committed to trying to address a number of these housing issues.
But I think we should speak now if we're not going to, because that's the other thing is down the road, I'd prefer not to have somebody leave the cart and then say, I never agreed to participate in it. That's an important step.
But then maybe to Mr. Ruskin's point or Mr. Hickey's, I think we need a little more information. It sounds like we've got a lead on a couple of, at least one or two very appropriate resources, but I think we need a little bit more in terms of, again, scope, deliverables, cost, et cetera, timeline. Mr. Fildebeck and Mr. Wojak.
And my question would be, Warren, if you could help, what kind of timeline are we looking at? We're going to be meeting with the county May 9th. I'd like to have something back so we would have some ideas. Is that possible? Is that not possible?
That would be a rush, but I think that we can try to get them get their attention and get a timetable for action from them. I think that they can jump back in pretty quick. It depends on their other commitments around the country. But we can contact them in the morning and find out and get back to your staff or
be a good idea, and that way we would know, and that way we're at least looking at it. But we, again, I think the problem is, Councilman Wojak spoke about earlier, some of these things get out there, we don't put dates on, we don't put end lines on, and then they just kind of slide down the road. So that's why
I might have misunderstood your question. Could you get a scope of work from them very quickly? Yes, you can get that from them within a matter of days.
And I think that's what we've really been looking at, because that was a question that Council President Staver was asking, how soon could we get?
Yeah,
could we get that information that way? That would answer the question.
5 days.
That Mr. Ruskin,
definition. Right.
Mr. Roy. So, and to all the comments about, you know, getting this information in front of us, you're all completely right about that. And obviously, we need an RCA to kick this off, anyways. So, the idea would be, you know, getting these materials together, having staff kind of understanding what we're looking for here, and you know, come the next council meeting, we can have an RCA that includes all of that information in front of us.
I'd be comfortable with that as the council action.
Okay. Let's see if we can pull it together that quickly.
And are we asking Warren
you got
to
that?
Facilitate that since he has a contact?
do you have a preference, Mr. City Administrator? I mean, Terry Spaeth has worked with Warren. He's worked with, you know, I know Gary's worked with us too. I mean, what's the best way for us
we
to
help
Terry this together?
Continue that coordination.
I mean, ultimately, basically we're trying to put together an RCA and information for the council for the next council meeting.
Well,
for the next council meeting, you talked about the 9th of May.
Well, that's the, that's
the city council.
This would be for the RCA to kick off the work. The next, that's a city that's a city-county meeting.
If you can get it sooner, that's great. I just didn't want it to link.
And what I was going to suggest is, assuming we can get that RCA going by then, I think it'd be great to have them at the meeting. You know, as the county tells us what they're doing on housing, we can share that we're doing some things on housing now, too.
Well, let's see what he's able to pull together. It's fairly aggressive to have something in 2 weeks, but let's see what you're able to do.
So I understand in 2 weeks you want a possible contract with Cornerstone? Before the council, for your consideration?
At least for consideration.
Yeah, right, for consideration.
And a scope of work. Scope of work and the contract, so we can have those to consider.
Right, we'll give you a little extra time.
I found the City of Hopkins stuff that they did, and it's pretty straightforward, so it's not really complex.
So if we can pull that together in time for consideration, it should at least be a discussion item at a minimum. Whether we're ready to take action, if enough definition has been created, so be it. But we certainly would want to, again, Mr. Bilderback's point, we've got to keep kind of putting a stick in the ground so that we make forward progress. So this should, at a minimum, be an item for discussion in 2 weeks. If it's codified in the form of an RCA, great.
Ms. Means. Can we also have a review of the sample ordinance to look at that time as well?
No chance. They'll have to. I mean, if you want to look at Minneapolis's, but it's not going to directly apply to us.
Right.
And you have to find something from Minnesota, because Minnesota law is incredibly complicated when it comes to this stuff. I've tried to do that, and not even Terry would give me credit for my legal expertise on this one. So.
Well, all right.
I'm really encouraged by the people that are here in support of this initiative, especially since the Maxfield study has been quite in the past now. And so we're moving forward. We need it for our community. Our community is growing. So I just like to thank everybody for listening today. And this is a positive step for us, I think.
Well, I think it speaks to the fact housing is one of the cornerstone initiatives for the council, certainly this year, if not in prior years, along with transit, transportation, comprehensive plan, a few other things that will clearly drive a lot of the activity in our community for several decades to come.
Can I just ask that we continue to receive an update as you start surveying the kind of economic components of the community and figure out what the raise looks like? Because I think I try and remain pragmatic about this. We need to have the right size public investment and the right size private investment. And as we, as the two pieces move forward, I think it serves us to touch base relatively frequently, so we make sure we're moving kind of in lockstep. So as you move forward with your initiatives and marshaling all the resources, continue to update us on about what the size of the investment looks like. I think that'll just be fundamental for us to continue kind of move this entire initiative forward. So appreciate the presentation.
As often as you would like me to, I will come here and do that. And if I may, Mr. President, in response to your remarks earlier, if I may emphasize that last item, I hesitated to even put that on the slide because the city has been such robust partners in the past. But I want you to understand what that does for me as I move out into the community and talk to people about participating in fundraising or whatever it is to advance this cause. I can say that the city has formally agreed to be a part of this collaborative voluntary collaborative we've put together. It gives me strength, it gives me gravitas in the community. So this wasn't meant as any way to denigrate your contribution in the past or question it going forward, other than what it does for the movement to have you folks signed on formally that you're participating in this process.
Okay. I would note we've had several meetings with Steve lately on this topic, so we've been meeting with him kind of regularly anyway.
Okay.
Just one more. I feel that the changes to the incentive development are really important. And there's a number of here that are just labeled, you know, eliminate or make code requirement, which are essentially eliminate. I think, you know, it would be fantastic to push this forward. And I know that there's a staff limitation. We need to understand that. But many of these changes will probably be select and delete. And so if that is the case, we may be able to, you know, may be able to do this even internally. I don't know.
What I would suggest is this evening, what you might do under other business is initiate a text amendment and ask staff, because I agree these are fairly straightforward. These might not be the totality of all the changes we're talking about, but it's a start, and the text changes are fairly straightforward. So you could make that motion this evening and at least get that rolling.
Plan to make a motion. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else on this topic? We have one other topic this afternoon.
I could talk all night on this topic.
Probably with the time limitations in the dinner. And
I'm sorry?
Probably with the time limitations in your dinner appointment, we should probably do this tonight.
Do what tonight?
Talk about that Chateau RFP.
Okay. Are there people here to discuss?
So talk about that. Talk about the Chateau tonight under other business?
The other business tonight.
Unless there are other people, unless you want to take the time right now.
What's the consensus of the council? You want to do this this evening?
I prefer to do it now.
I prefer to do it now.
What's that? What time?
10 minutes.
Oh, my apologies. I didn't realize.
I could have.
Well, I'm not going to.
It's going to be a short meeting tonight, so we'll.
Right. Okay, we'll do it tonight. That's fine. Sorry, I thought it was 5:30. I wasn't ready. Don't read my actions. I may bring it up again. Here you go, Mr.
Yeah. Okay.